Hello, and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about two new movies that are out in the theaters and available to stream. The first is the German movie Undine, and the second is a documentary, Street Gang, How We Got to Sesame Street. And Undine is from 2020. The second one is from 2021. So we're going to talk first about Undine. And Mike, I have to say, first of all, that the minute I saw the title of the movie, I thought, oh, Undine and Sintram, because I'm a huge fan of Louisa May Alcott's books, particularly Little Women. And in Little Women, one of the books that they read and talk about is Undine and Sintram. And since those names are so unusual, I've never forgotten it, even though I'd never actually read either of those books until recently when this came up. And I thought, you know, I started looking into it and I, you know, found the novella, which, by the way, if anybody is interested in reading the back story, the actual novella this movie is sort of referencing, you can get it for free on Gutenberg because it's now in the public domain. But this is a German movie, Mike, and I know you teach a whole course on German film. So why don't we start off by, you know, sort of talking about how this fits into German film.
Absolutely. A lot of contemporary German cinema asks the big existential questions. And in fact, when I teach my German film history course, sometimes the students will tease me and say, aren't you going to show any comedies? And I'll say, well, you know, German film comedies? And in fact, the Germans actually make a lot of comedies, but they don't travel well. In other words, some humor doesn't cross borders, and things that Germans find funny on film don't excite other people quite the same way. But that's like a whole separate discussion almost. But in teaching the German film history course, there are a lot of German films in which there's an existential and kind of ambivalent quality, even in terms of character and motivation. And also sometimes contemporary stories that do have mythic resonance in various ways. I mean, think of like one of the all-time great examples that I do use in my German film history course is Wim Wenders' Wings of Desire. I mean, you literally have angels coming into contemporary Berlin and all the big questions being asked. And it's sometimes humorous, but oftentimes very, very serious. So in terms of the series underpinnings for this film, Undine, it's based on a European myth about a water sprite. And she can fall in love and become human, but she must suffer if her lover's been unfaithful. I mean, that's sort of the essence, the kernel of the film. And we'll double back on how that plays out in this, you know, very contemporary story. But since you did ask me about German film history, one of the most interesting contemporary German film directors, and indeed he's sort of come along since I started teaching the German film course, I need to get him into it at this point, is Christian Petzold. I think he's one of the most talented of the younger German filmmakers today. The film of his I like a lot is Barbara from 2012, in which the title character is a doctor in East Germany in 1980. And the Stasi, the East German spy agency, is spying on her in terms of her beliefs and her intentions and on that way. And it's, you know, the actress Nina Haas is the star of that. And it's a really involving character study. The other film of his that is fairly recent that I'd recommend, I've got some mixed feelings about it, but Phoenix from 2015. It really involves a World War II era story, and I don't want to get bogged down in the storyline because it has all kinds of complications in it, but essentially, you know, the female protagonist was in the death camp, somehow survived, but she was, shot, and she had reconstructive surgery, and she, to some extent, doesn't even look like what she once looked like. She comes back to find that her husband has divorced her, doesn't initially recognize her, but thinks she looks close enough to what his dead, presumably dead wife was, that he asks her if she'll impersonate the dead wife so that he can get a hold of her estate. You know, so that's a starting point. My goodness, where it's going to go from there. The other one I'll mention very quickly is his most recent film that I've seen, Transit from 2019. And this is a case where it's such a puzzle movie. It's such a head scratcher that German forces somehow invade modern day, present day Paris. It's some sort of existential never-never land. When is this taking place? Wait a minute, it reminds me of World War II, but it's contemporary. So what happens in all the movies I mentioned by Christian Petzold is they are psychological thrillers with all kinds of twists and turns and a hefty dose of what I oftentimes just simply call magic realism. In the film we're going to talk about today, you have, you know, a semblance of that. There are scenes, there are moments saying, no, wait a minute, is this really happening? Or wait a minute, is she fully human? You know, I mean, you have those moments where you kind of wonder, wait a minute, what's happening underwater here? You know, are there, it's almost like asking, do mermaids really exist kind of questions, right? Like what's actually going on here? So that's a good way, I think, to set the stage here, that this is a very characteristic German film. His works have all been widely screened in this country, well-received. So among cineasts, I love to use that word, but among real film buffs, this is a director that people keep an eye on. So when I see him, it really is, you know, on the art house circuit where he's extremely well-regarded. And so a movie like Undine, I would refer to as sort of a high-end date. You know, like if you want to impress your date, that you don't go to see trash, you go to see really good movies. And not only that, and you know, joking aside, it's the kind of movie where even if you have mixed feelings about it, you want to talk about it afterwards. It really leads to what I call parking lot conversations. You know, you leave the theater, you're talking to your friends, like, what was that all about? And then, you know, it's nice to disagree sometimes. You know, I like it, I don't like it, or this is what she is, or that's what she is. Because there are other movies that I like, but there's nothing to say other than I liked it. So this is a movie that I not only like, but I like to talk about.
Well, I'm glad because we're going to talk about it. So the fable, if you will, about Undine is that a water spirit marries a knight to gain a soul. A knight, not, you know, the knight of during the day, you know, K-N-I-G-H-T. It's also references a French folktale where the knight can't see her on Saturdays when she resumes mermaid shape. So when I was looking at this, and that story was all about her having to have privacy in the bath, because when she was in the bath, her mermaid tail would come back, which reminded me, and for the first time since 1984, of Splash, the Tom Hanks, Daryl Hannah movie, where, you know, at one point she's relaxing in the tub and, you know, you see her tail, you know, start to emerge because, you know, she's really a mermaid. And I thought, I had completely forgotten about that scene. So I enjoyed the fact that Undine made me remember that, and that whole idea of the mermaid who's can sometimes, you know, take human form. I thought there was a nice bit of magical realism that you pointed out. There is an element of the supernatural in this film, which sort of reminded me, tell me what you think, Mike, of the movie The Shape of Water. And I also want to know how it played in the theater when you saw it at the Charles. Now, I rented it on Amazon Prime for $6.99. Again, I think that's kind of a deal. But, you know, you saw it in the theater. Better in the theater, worth the money. What did everybody else in the theater think?
I'm squandering my money and my time because I would pay more than that to see it. But anyway, it's interesting when you mentioned comparisons and things like Splash. I did think about Splash. I mean, you know, there aren't that many mermaid movies, so I'm going to think about it. And I must confess, I met Daryl Hannah once, and I got to confess, I looked at her feet. How could I not? I'm thinking like, you know, like you know, she had normal human feet, but I had to look, right? You know,
They weren't webbed at all?
No, so far as I could tell, they weren't webbed, you know, and I didn't look that closely, but, you know, from a safe distance. But anyway, the thing is, this is a story that does verge on and really kind of meld into the mythic material that it's based on. You're absolutely right, Marie. And it's a very contemporary story in terms of the characters and their occupations and street life and this and that. But there's always this mysterious aura. Who are these people really? What are they really all about? And it's one of those movies that has to walk that fine line between what I would call everyday realism, because it's about the title character and her amorous relationships, specifically with two men, and how those play out. But as that's happening, partly because of the mythic underpinnings, also partly because of whether it's, you know, music or camera angles, any number of things where you feel like this is not kitchen sink realism. It's being shot a bit differently and so on. And so it really is going to take us into like quasi-mythic material. And I think it does it in a way that always holds my interest. Did I always find it convincing? Well, how convincing can a mermaid story be? I mean, it's sort of a weird question even to think about. But at that level, yeah. And also, one reason why it's such an art house favorite is art house audiences. And at the Charles, admittedly, the crowd I saw it was not even a crowd. So few people, it's not a fair gauge that way. Oh, yeah, the other guy liked it too, kind of thing, you know. So, you know, I sort of sidestepped that because it wasn't really a big house, as they say. But the kind of ambiguity, and I'm being only partially facetious here, that art house audiences like. They like that so much because you can have conversations like this one. So here's a, for instance, early in the film of the kind of ambiguity that the movie really handles very well and in a kind of creepy way even. She has two lovers, okay? And so she's the one Johannes, you know, she's not getting along with. There's some tension there. And early in the film, when they're talking to each other, she actually says, this is an exact quote, she says, "If you leave me, I'll have to kill you." Now, I know in everyday usage, people say that all the time. I mean, how often, like, you know, even like an angry mother to her child, "If you don't stop that, I'm going to kill you." Well, fortunately, it doesn't actually get followed through on for the most part, right? But we all know the expression, how quick we can be to say things like that. You know, "If you ever leave me, I'll kill you." Well, she might well mean it. And that's why, as you're watching it, I mean, she seems like a fairly decent person. She works as an historian lecturing on the history of Berlin. Again, this is a movie that delves into a kind of archaeology of the city itself. How many cities have a past as rich and as troubled as Berlin's, right? So she actually, like in a museum context, gives lectures about the history of Berlin. She's also delving so deep into a kind of personal archaeology that at some point, archaeology, as in history we can trace and put in a museum case, that kind of melds into mythology. You know, go back far enough and, well, what really happened in Troy? You know, what really happened here or there? And I think the movie actually very astutely deals with things like that. Her very occupation takes you back in time. Why not go a little further back and think of her maybe as the reincarnation or whatever of some kind of water sprite? I mean, that she might actually have that quality. And so the one guy in her life has kind of crossed her. The second guy she'll be involved with, Christoph, has the perfect occupation. He's a diver who works underwater welding turbines, you know, so he actually is underwater a lot. The moment you get below the surface and you start swimming around like that, who knows what you're going to encounter? I mean, again, the everyday realism of it is that's what the guy does for a living, you know, and now he's involved with her romantically. But when you think about the mythic underpinnings for the story and her kind of personal stories of you know, bad luck and love, if you will, when she gets hooked up with this second guy, Christoph, the audience at that point is put into a place, a watery place, where, Marie, when you mentioned Shape of Water, yes, I thought about that too. The nature of water, you know, in terms of, you know, it's not solid, obviously. It's not something you can grasp readily. All those metaphoric ways we could talk about it, that these are characters who, at least a few of them, are more comfortable in the water. And also the fact that when you think about water, again, in terms of mythology, you know, well, where does Venus on the half shell come from? You know, the fact that women and romantic associations with women, right, that kind of richness and fertility coming out of the sea, out of the water, if you will, life itself, right, coming out of the water. So in her case, she seems like she's fully capable of living on dry land or underwater. So even though, like, logically you could pick it apart or say, I don't quite get it or buy it, whatever, the director is so skillful that he takes you along in a way that you're receptive to it, to what she's all about. And again, enough of that ambiguity that makes it an art house favorite.
Now, in terms of the mood of the movie, I think it is very successful. And I think you were kind of alluding to this. One thing is, you know, there's a moment where a fish tank shatters, which is, you know, crucial to the plot. The other is the repeated use of statues. There's statuary in the diner, where the outside cafe, really, where she's, you know, having an interaction with one of the lovers that she has. But there's also, it's not a statue, it's a little figurine of the diver, which has, you know, emotional significance for her. Wanted to ask you what you thought about the use of that kind of visual. And also whether you thought there was a little bit of a callback to Run Lola Run, just because the main character has red hair.
Oh, I wasn't expecting a red hair question, a red herring question, maybe not red hair.
Red herring question.
Now, Marie, in terms of the statuary, I'm not entirely sure, but I tend to read it in a kind of art historical / archaeological way. That this is a movie that does, you know, if you start thinking about those origin myths and so on, at some point you are going to think about a marble statue or something, right? So I tended to think that way, the things that anchor us to the past. But beyond that, I'm not entirely sure, because you're right, it's a visual motif that recurs. The other thing you said that made me smile so much is romantic movies almost always have a meet cute moment. With this director's rather sardonic take on that, his meet cute moment for Christoph and our title character is that they will actually meet when a fish tank in a cafe explodes for who knows what reason. I mean, it's one of the magic realism moments. I don't just mean like it leaks. I mean, it explodes and there's like water and fish everywhere. That's how these two characters will meet. So surely they're destined to be a couple in a movie like this one. I mean, you know, they've got the remnants of a fish tank all around them. And it turns out, guess what? He's a diver. He's underwater all the time. And guess what? She might well be a mermaid for all we know. Boy, you know, they are destined for each other. I mean, it's like goo goo eyes and falling in love at that point. But this is, again, where the movie, it has enough audacity to do a scene like that. Now, whether it works for you or not, because it's pretty extreme, it gets your attention. And because the film has pulled you into this kind of mythic structure, you have to, at some point, honestly, just like, you know, give it props, pay it respect. Like it has established its own ground rules, right? And so I didn't find myself scoffing at that exploding fish tank scene. I thought, whoa, you know, and it's like, I was not expecting it. But then my next thought was, well, yeah, within the storyline and the thematic structure, something like that could happen. And in a movie like this one, once you open the door to mythic subject matter, you know, you have a pretty long lead there. You can take it all sorts of places. And if the audience is willing to go with you, it's like, well, okay, maybe she is a water spirit reincarnated. And the moment you find yourself receptive to that, they've got you. Sorry, hook, line, and sinker. They've got you at that point.
You're absolutely right. Now, I thought the shattering aquarium scene was clever, because otherwise it's a window into a mythic world. The minute it breaks, suddenly, so is the barrier between the two worlds, which I thought was very effective. What I would say was not effective for me, and I'm hoping you're going to tell me what I missed about this technique, because I thought they relied on it too much, was the emphasis on her, you know, the historian giving tours, sort of being this knowledgeable docent. I felt like that bogged the movie down, that they spent too much time with that. And I didn't think that that advanced the plot, but what did you think?
Well, I think it advances the plot to a limited degree. I think it's important to have it there by way of how she's linked to the history of Berlin and who knows what earlier histories even. Again, the mythic roots, if you will, coming into it. But I absolutely agree with you that within the film, too much of the running time is given, frankly, to, you know, these lectures. I mean, I'll be polite and say it's generous in those scenes. As she's talking about this and that and the history of Berlin and her audience is walking through the exhibit with her, you know, a few minutes of that would be enough to get the point across. I absolutely agree with you that what she was saying was of some interest. I would be on the tour, right? I would find it, but it's not essential for the film beyond a certain point. And you're right, Maria, it tends to slow it down in a way. And it becomes, and this is, Christian Petzold does not always have a light hand. He can be a bit heavy-handed with his scripting elements. And I think you've identified one of them here. It's almost like the academic in him, if you will. It's the pedantic quality of that he's done all this research, doubtless, into the history of Berlin, and he's also his own screenwriter, and he's screenwriter / director. You're going to get it, you know what I mean? And we all sort of know that, Marie. You and I, like, if you've done your homework, you've done your research, you're going to inflict it on your audience, whether they want it or not, because I did all that research, and you're going to hear this whether you want to or not. This is where it would have been advantageous, perhaps, to have somebody else with creative input who might say, well, you know, Christian, you know, maybe rather than like X number of minutes, maybe if you cut it by a few. And that might seem like hair splitting, but it's not, because the film needs to have a certain pace. And this film generally is well paced, but Marie, you're right. Every time it would cut back to her giving a history lecture, I mean, I never go out for popcorn or anything at a time. I mean, I sit through every frame, right? But I'm sitting there thinking, you know, we don't need this. And it really kind of slows the pace almost to a halt. So yeah, you're absolutely right about that.
Now, I will say, I really thought that was the only flaw in the movie. I thought this was a really cool, interesting movie, beautifully shot, beautifully acted. But in terms of the next time you do German film, Mike, is this something you would include? And if you did, why? And if you would not, then why for that too?
I would definitely include this director. I mean, in terms of films he's made in the last few years, if I were picking film, as indicated before, Barbara is probably the film of his I would use. And towards the end of that German film history course, we have films from the 1980s and 90s that talk about those final years of the East German regime and the changeover from that to a united Germany. And a film like Barbara actually fits well within that context. But to, you know, cut to the chase in terms of your direct question, I would be willing to use this film in the course. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's not my favorite among his films, but he's done strong work. He's done consistently interesting work. Let's put it this way, that even if you're not crazy about the film, you might be intrigued by him as a director. And that's why I mentioned those other films. Like, hey, check out, you know, these two or three other films by the same director. But, you know, honestly, any one of the films I mentioned by this director would work in a course like that.
If you're going to just excerpt one clip from this to try to get your students a German film to watch it, which scene would it be?
I don't think you can top an exploding fish tank. I mean, as a kid, I had a big fish tank and I used to worry about leaks, but this goes way beyond the standard leak.
Great answer, Mike. You were right on top of that. All right, we're now going to switch gears and talk about a completely different movie that we couldn't even figure out how to, you know, juxtapose. It's just completely different. This is not a German film at all. This is a documentary about Sesame Street called Street Gang, How We Got to Sesame Street, which came out this year. And your only option at the moment, if you want to stream it, it's $14.99 from Amazon Prime. Now, of course, as time goes on, you'll be able to rent it for cheaper, but that's the going rate if you just have to see it today. And this is a documentary about the origins of that famous show. So, Mike, tell us about how this played at the Charles.
Again, you know, this is a film that I saw in the theater, but it was a small enough audience that it's not fair to you know, I didn't interview people afterwards, but maybe the way for me to come at it is to think about the source material. I have to say, growing up, Sesame Street was not part of my personal experience. I mean, I knew of it certainly, but it wasn't like somehow that I was weaned on it. And yet what really got me thinking about it was as a professional film critic in 1979, I interviewed Jim Henson when he was doing the Muppet movie. Talked to Henson and Frank Oz and other people involved with the first Muppet movie. Then I did my homework, I did my research, and you know, really went back and studied Sesame Street, just the cultural importance of it. And what I liked about this documentary is it spends quality time on that very issue. How in the late 1960s, you have the formation of, you know, PBS, of public television, how important Sesame Street is to that early history and from there to the present. And the fact that, you know, back then so many people worried about, you know, television as a cultural wasteland and, you know, something argued over in Congress as much as anywhere else. And if you're going to have a public broadcasting network, the kinds of programming you want. And one of the things the documentary does a good job on, again, is just taking us back. Joan Ganz Cooney, you know, was the single figure more than anyone else who really put this show together. But the documentary also reinforces the point that other people worked on it too. One of the unsung heroes is the director, writer, producer, John Stone. When you watch the film, it's like, boy, how did I not know about him or not know much about him? And he did as much as anybody. So it really kind of takes you through that history. And in a cultural sense, even though, again, I wasn't like watching it myself back in the day, I was well aware of it. And I realized the extent to which it really fulfilled its educational mission. Let me give you a great example of how this works. And the documentary does a really sweet job of this as well. You know, because it's a, you know, preschool audience, if you will, it's really young kids who are the target audience for Sesame Street. Let's say you have a segment where you want to teach them their colors. This is yellow, you know, and point to something else. What's the name of this? And, you know, a precocious tyke will shout, that's blue. You know, so you go through your colors that way. How natural a segue to go from those colors to different colors in people. Here's a white person, here's a black person, a brown person, whatever. And you don't have to even like overtly like club someone over the head with it. It's just simply you have an interracial cast at a time when that was not common in television. And the fact that it's handled so naturally, you don't have to state the obvious. You just simply have, you know, a white person and a black person and a brown person and a, you know, yellow person, whatever, you know, name your colors of humanity. You have all those colors of humanity talking about the colors the kids have as they use their crayons, right? What a perfect teaching vehicle to have that. I mean, it's really wonderfully handled. And also what impressed me about the film was the fact that even though this is ostensibly a show teaching kids about those most basic things from, you know, the preschool classroom, if you will, it also has to tackle some really tough issues like mortality. And my favorite moment in the film actually was when one of the actors, Will Lee, had died. And they need to somehow explain that within the show, right? Like one of the actors you see as a certain character, Mr. Hooper, you know, like week by week, he's not going to be here anymore. Well, why won't he be here anymore? That was, I mean, I was getting out my handkerchief there. It really was a tearful moment as the other characters on the show explained to the kids why this character would no longer be there. What does it mean for someone to die? My goodness, what a mature treatment of probably the most difficult subject life offers us, death. And the fact that a show like this, and of course, you know, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood would do similar things of where it would take you into territory in terms of in the late 60s into the 70s, you know, racial harmony, things that still were, you know, and still are today, touchy topics, but also ways in which you can take a children's playroom kind of setting and deal with life's biggest questions. So it's one of the things I always liked about it. And that's why, even though, you know, the Muppets and other elements could be so silly, and that's fine, you know, silliness is good in its own right, you could also use that as a tool to help introduce kids to more serious topics, whether it's based on, you know, the classroom learning experience or the life learning experience, things you need to learn in life.
And the scene you're talking about, you know, the way they decided to handle it is to have Big Bird be the character who would be like a child, where they didn't quite understand that, oh, that person's gone, but they're never coming back. You know, that needs to be explained. And Big Bird was, you know, the face of the child, you know, trying to work through these things. Now, Sesame Street was specifically geared towards children 3 to 5 years old, which is why I think I also didn't really grow up with Sesame Street, although I knew about it. It was too young for me. I do remember them dragging TVs into the classroom when I was in elementary school to show us the Electric Company. None of us were fooled. We could see the whole trick. Oh, you're going to drag in a television thinking we're going to be excited to watch television, but we know it's educational, so we're not buying it. You know, the only thing I will say about the Electric Company, though, is that if you go back and watch those episodes, you can see Morgan Freeman, a very young Morgan Freeman, as the easy reader. But we did not appreciate the Electric Company the way kids love Sesame Street. And I think it's because Sesame Street is meant to be a regular street with real people coexisting with monsters and children. It's such a perfect way to describe the way 3 to 5 year old kids see the world. Wonderful things about it, this movie, are all the people that you'll see in it that you know, like, you know, Diana Shore, Madeline Kahn, Jesse Jackson, Stevie Wonder, B.B. King, Loretta Lynn does a wonderful song with The Count, you know, You Can Count on Me, Sophia Loren, Paul Simon. So it's wonderful to see all of the people who showed up as guest stars on this show. But we are coming to the end of our segment, Mike. So I'm going to give it to you real quickly to say, get your take on whether you think this has any Oscar chances as a documentary, and whether you would use this in your course that you teach about the documentary film.
I think it actually does stand a good chance of getting an Oscar nomination, at least. I mean, as filmmaking, it's not great filmmaking. I don't mean that in a derogatory way. It's functional, right? It tells the story well. But you wouldn't, on stylistic grounds, say it's a great film that way. But it's an important subject, and it's very well handled. So yes, to your question, I think it might well be certainly worthy of an Oscar nomination. I probably wouldn't use it in the course I teach on documentary films, which, again, is not to slight it, but just simply I can think of other films I probably would use instead. But it is a film that, you know, ironically does work well in the classroom. And so there are any number of courses where for sure you could use it. And, you know, again, it's looking back that way, to see how the program itself evolved. And Marie, as you mentioned, all the celebrities who were on it, they look really young too, not quite 3 to 5 years old, but what they looked like back in the 1970s, let's say. So, oh my goodness. And of course, you always find yourself looking at how they dressed and the hairstyles and all that. So there's a bit of time capsule value as well as to how these celebrities look back in the day.
Now, I will also say as a final note that you should watch this movie, if only for the end, when all these people join in to sing, Put Down the Ducky. Wonderful moment, especially because, you know, you probably remember that song. But that does bring us to the end of our segment. Don't forget to check out our other episodes on dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. And you can also find us on Spotify and Pandora under Dragon Digital Radio. And we will see you at the movies.
We'll see you then.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.